The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. Calling case number A220887 in the matter of the civil commitment of Earl Lionel Ward.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
And I want to welcome you all to this remote oral argument for the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Before we begin, I do have a few opening comments. First of all, while we are holding this argument remotely, the same rules apply as they would if we were in the Minnesota Judicial Center. But there are some things to keep in mind. The format of this, or the platform, allows us to have a screen dedicated to the clock. So you should be able to see the clock, but if you're having a hard time, it may be because you need to switch between your gallery view and the active speaker view so that you can see that. So I want to make sure to say that so you know how much time is remaining as you present your argument. I also want to mention that only the attorneys and the judges are able to share to show their video and speak today. And from time to time, we understand there may be a problem, an interruption. We'll do what we can to keep these at a minimum, and we will work to ensure that you have all the time to which you're entitled to present your argument to us this morning. The last thing is, please take a moment when you begin speaking to pronounce your name and your client's name for us, and let us know if you or your client have any preferences for us to know about when we reference you. And with that, Mr. Kufis, did I get your name, Kufis?
You're close, Your Honor. Close. Kufis.
Kufis. Okay. Well, thank you for correcting me, and I'm sorry I got it wrong the first time.
No, not.
Are you prepared to proceed, Mr. Kufis?
Yes, but if I could, Your Honor, I mentioned this to Ms. Siegel when we first came in, but I have a cold right now, and so I've got a pretty nasty cough, and I have a cough drop in. If that's okay with the court, I know that that's technically, but I would, if it's okay with the court, I would rather have that than the coughing fits.
No, I appreciate you bringing it up, and that is 100% okay from us.
Okay.
If there, for some reason, we need you to repeat yourself, we'll jump in. No worries.
That sounds good. That sounds
right.
Good. So yes, with that, Your Honor, I am prepared to proceed.
All right, you may begin.
Panel, Mr. Hamilton, my name is Dan Kufis, and I am representing Earl Lionel Ward. Mr. Ward was committed as a sexually dangerous person under Minnesota Statute 253D.02, Subdivision 15. And he was also committed as a sexually psychopathic personality under 253D.02, Subdivision 16. By order dated April 28th of 2022, Ramsey County issued an order civilly committing under the two statutes that were just mentioned. What we are requesting the court today is to reverse that order, or in the alternative, we ask that it be reversed and remanded for a new hearing. And this, I think, as you can probably see with the voluminous nature of this case, as well as the switchings of counsel, this is a unique case with a lot of different moving parts within it. And I think that in order for us to, what I'm trying to get across and what I would like the court today to look at is looking at the totality of what occurred during that trial and whether or not Mr. Ward got a fair trial and so, whether or not.
So counsel, I want to jump in for a moment. When you talk about the totality of the trial, I mean, the things that jump out at me are six or seven continuances, all at the request of your client. There's a finding at the bottom of page 10 and the top of page 11 of the district court's order where there's a finding that your client made a number of interruptions, made a number of pro se motions whenever he desired, and that he was uncooperative with his counsel such that counsel was unable to bring witnesses forward, and there was no objection to any of the exhibits. So when we look at the totality of the proceedings, including those things, which I think are fairly a fair description of what happened, what is it about this proceeding really that you're claiming is unfair or violative of his due process rights.
Well, and Your Honor, I think to go back, if I could just address one of those issues first, and then I'll Mr. Maddox didn't object, but he reserved his right to object to the credibility. And that's part of the transcript. So he did reserve that right to object to the credibility, which he never did get a chance. The two major things that I see with it are the issue of the examiner and whether or not the issue of choosing the examiner is a choice to be made by counsel or is it to be made by the patient.
So let's talk about the examiner, because the examiner was chosen by counsel.
Yep.
Your client didn't object, right?
Well, he did object. He didn't
when
object.
When did he object? After the examination, right?
That's correct. Yep.
So the examiner was selected. He goes to the examination. He participates in the examination. The examiner issues the report and then he objects, right?
Right.
Okay. And then he has not identified as of today an alternative examiner and what that alternative examiner would have said. Is that true?
Well, his family was looking at different examiners, but as part of the record, there is no specific examiner that's been pointed out. You are correct, Your Honor.
So what's the downstroke on that? I mean, he consented by his participation.
Well, and that's where I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, Your Honor. By consenting, by participating, it's my understanding that Mr. Ward had these objections to his counsel that weren't made to the court. But
so let me just remind you of the paragraph 19 of the district court's order where Mr. Ward made a number of pro se motions, interrupted counsel and proceedings throughout the seven continuances. So he knew how to object if he wanted to, right?
Well, with the exam, I think that it's a little bit different because it's not going with any specific hearing at that time. If he doesn't participate in the exam, say that he doesn't participate in the examiner, whether it's the one that he chose or whether it's one that anybody else chose, writes the report based solely off of the records. So there would still be a report written whether or not he sat for the exam or he didn't.
Can I ask you this, Mr. Kufis? What record evidence would support your maybe explicit, maybe implicit assertion that Dr. Robertson was not an appropriate examiner?
Well, number one, this was the first time that Dr. Robertson had ever conducted one of these. And that came out in the record. This was his very first time ever conducting one.
Can I step back a bit on this point and ask to make sure, I didn't see you challenging the ambiguity of the statutory requirement regarding selection of an examiner, right?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if I necessarily see it as being ambiguous.
That's my question. Are you arguing that the statute's ambiguous because it's subject to two different meanings, him personally or his attorney? Both could be reasonable. Or are you saying it's unambiguous and clear? It's only one of those possible meanings. I just wanted to know from my standpoint as I try to frame these issues and figure out what threshold questions we have to ask, whether you're challenging the statute because it's ambiguous, or are you arguing it's unambiguous?
Your Honor, I would say at this time that it's unambiguous. The statute says specifically of the patient's choosing. And there's an obligation under the rules that an attorney for somebody who's going through a civil commitment consult with their client before any of those decisions are made, before any of the hearings.
And I didn't see in your brief any specific authority, legal authority or case law, and perhaps there isn't. It seems a bit odd to think of a case that would generate this rule of law, but I didn't see a specific case that says, that sort of interprets that statute or clarifies that means him personally as opposed to his attorney. There's no case that you presented to us. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
There is no case that I presented on that. And I think, I mean, obviously in most cases, when you have an attorney who does, who's an experienced civil commitment attorney who does a number of these, and it's a choice that they would typically be in a better position to make. But in this case, where you have somebody who was voicing that they didn't support that, I think that needs to be taken into consideration.
Is there any requirement that the district court go through sort of a waiver with the defendant or a colloquy with the parties to make sure that this is something that he personally has agreed to? Is there any requirement, a rule that clearly says a district court has this obligation?
No, but Your Honor, I would point out that he wasn't at the hearing where this was discussed. He wasn't either told about or arrangements being made for him to participate in that hearing. So in looking at it, I think that also the once we get past the issue of the examiner, I think that the second major one being the issue of Mr. Ward's witnesses that he had for rebuttal purposes.
Well, what do you make of the district court's finding that Mr. Ward did not provide his counsel with addresses or contact information for these witnesses such that they could be called? I mean, you're not claiming that paragraph 19 was clearly erroneous, are you?
Well, but I think, Your Honor, with the issue, I think that you can see that there's clearly some disagreement or differences between my client and his counsel at the district court level about this issue. He, according to him and on the record, he had provided these.
And then the other thing that I didn't see in the record, and I went through it pretty closely, is any kind of offer of proof as to what any of these witnesses would have testified to had they been called. Did I miss that?
No, you didn't.
Okay.
No, Your Honor, I didn't see that either in the court record. And even if there's not an offer of proof, I think it can go back to this whole issue of, did he get a fair shake at this? And I realized that during the trial, the court found that there were interruptions, but this is somebody who's passionate about, I mean, this is a serious case for him. He's passionate about his own defense and he wanted to be involved. And in this case, he wasn't. And
Mr. Kufis, assuming that we get past these sort of procedural challenges and we're now looking at the merits of the ultimate decisions here, what is your argument to us this morning regarding those decisions?
Your Honor, are you talking about the end finding that he should be
correct? Correct. And the basis for it under both of the, what I think of as SDP and SPP, to use too many acronyms, but.
Yes, yes, and the SDP. They got one side of the story, Your Honor. And I don't think that with the rebuttal witnesses, and again, there was no offer of proof, but the rebuttal witnesses, according to Mr. Ward, would have come in and rebutted some of that.
Right. I guess my question is, assuming that we do not agree that there were any procedural problems, and so we're just left with looking at this record, are you conceding that it was not an abuse of discretion on this record for the district court to make those ultimate decisions? Or do you also have an argument that on this record, not considering something that wasn't presented that you think should have been, but just on what is the error in the exercise of discretion that the district court used here?
I think it was relying too much on the hearsay within the documents. That's the concern that I would have. Sorry, Judge Fritsch, I didn't know.
I think Judge Bjorkman has a question first.
Okay.
Yes, I'm having a hard time with getting my mute button to work. You know, my concern is that your argument is premised on arguments you didn't make in the district court. I mean, there's no objection to these exhibits. And as I see the exhibits, many of them are consistent with witness testimony that was adduced during the trial. How do we find error and improper reliance on documents to which there's no objection and that were supported by other evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that they were objected to by Mr. Maddox. Again, objecting, reserving the right to object to the credibility. I think one thing to keep in mind in this case is that after the hearing, Mr. Maddox had a stroke And that was before there could be the submissions, the final submissions on the case, the closing arguments. He had that stroke at that time. So he reserved that right to object to the credibility. In the commitment cases, I think as you know, the rules of evidence are more relaxed than they are in other areas. It's relevant, reliable evidence. So when that comes in, you have to question the reliability of what was in there. And in this case, Your Honor, I don't, especially with the DS case, if you look at DS at the time, she didn't make the allegations that she was testifying about at trial.
So, Mr. Kufis, if I could come back I want to be clear. You're making an argument not just that there were errors in, let's say, the admission of this purported hearsay evidence. You're also, it sounded like to me from reading your brief, making a separate independent argument that in the alternative, even if all those other things were not a problem during the trial, that there is some error in the district court's ultimate conclusions. And so I want to make sure that I'm clear. Is that last argument that you make, is that just derivative of the previous arguments? In other words, because there was this hearsay evidence admitted, for example, or because the district court herself asked these questions and you think that was inappropriate, is it just derivative of those other errors? Or are you making some alternative, separate, independent argument that the district court erred on this record when it made those conclusions?
I think that the district court erred on the record because it was an incomplete record.
Okay, so that sounds to me like that's completely derivative of the other arguments. And if we were to disagree with you on those other arguments, then we wouldn't have to address the exercise of, or we wouldn't have to review that exercise of discretion on the ultimate question, the ultimate decision, SDP-SPP. Am I misunderstanding something? Because it sounds like that's what you're saying, that if we disagree with you on arguments, I think you number them 1 through 4, but I could be misremembering the number system. So if we disagree with you on those, do we have to address the exercise of discretion on this record?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that we do, because when you tie it back in, I mean, it's an incomplete record that was addressed, but it's also a matter of the conflict between the hearsay that was brought in and the testimony of the witnesses was not flushed out.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have a chance on rebuttal to follow up on that. I'm still not exactly clear on how it would be a standalone argument if it relates back to the incompleteness of the record. It's that sounds like your primary error is not making a complete record. But we have some time on rebuttal, I think, to address that. Mr. Hamilton, are you prepared to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Robert Hamilton. I'm Assistant Ramsey County Attorney appearing on behalf of the respondent, Ramsey County. We are asking this court to affirm the trial court's order committing appellant as a sexually dangerous person and sexual psychopathic personality. Now, before I get into the argument, I did just want to clarify one thing that Mr. Kufis just said. He noted that Mr. Maddox, appellant's trial counsel, had a stroke prior to being able to lodge any objections or file proposed findings or post-trial motions. That is not accurate. Mr. Maddox did submit proposed findings. Mr. Maddox also filed a successful post-trial motion to strike the county's post-trial filings as untimely. So Mr. Maddox represented appellant through the post-trial phase, and he did have that opportunity to object to anything on credibility and to submit his proposed findings where the credibility of those documents that Mr. Kufis argues was addressed. Now, appellant engaged in a course of harmful sexual conduct spanning over 20 years. This course targeted strangers, acquaintances, and romantic partners, and it involved extreme violence and threats to the lives of the victims and their families. Appellant has never completed a sex offender treatment program, despite being a level 3 sex offender and repeatedly assessed as a high risk to sexually reoffend. And for over 25 years, appellant has maintained a directive to complete sex offender treatment, both while incarcerated and while under supervision in the community. And he's actively resisted these directives and has failed to complete any program in that time. Ramsey County filed this petition for indeterminate commitment in February 2021, and the matter was set for trial in June 2021. Between those dates, appellant had extensive conversations with his trial attorney regarding trial strategy, proposed witnesses, and the choice of appellant's examiner. At trial, the court heard testimony.
Counsel, what do we make of the fact that his examiner was selected when he wasn't present?
Your Honor, I don't know if the record is clear on that. The order appointing Mr. Robertson was filed in February of 2021. The hearings that appellant asserts that he did not attend, I believe, were in April and May of 2021, and those were pretrial hearings. They did not have to do with the selection of the second examiner. That selection had already been made. So I can't, there's no transcript. I don't have the orders handy from that hearing. I also don't know if that happened in conjunction with a hearing or if it was just a filing made by the appellant's attorney.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but as I think I understand the chronology, I mean, it's a voluminous record and I tried to get wrap my brain around it as much as possible, but help me out here. Mr. Ward was present in court at various hearings before that evaluation was completed. Is that right?
Your Honor, the record, I came into this case on appeal. I am unclear on that. I did look at pretrial records. It notes that appellant was represented by counsel, and contrast that there was a May motion hearing where it said that appellant waived his appearance. So Just piecing that together, my impression is that he was present at those hearings. However, I can't speak. I can't confirm that because I was not present at those hearings and the orders are unclear. Transcript.
Is it the county's position that the statute permits counsel to act on behalf of a client in selecting the evaluator?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And explain to me why that is. Explain to us, I guess, why that is.
Well, Your Honor, the county views the selection of an examiner as a matter of trial strategy. There is also, while there is no precedential case law that I've located on point, there is a persuasive unpublished opinion in Re Commitment of Cox, which we cite in our brief, where in that case, selection was made by an attorney without consulting with his client, and the court affirmed the commitment, did not find reversible error in that decision. The one thing that the court did stress was the importance of consultation with the client prior to selection of the examiner. And the record is clear here that consultation did occur in this case. Mr. Maddox noted in court that he had extensive conversations with appellant and his family regarding the selection of the second examiner. And he also noted, I believe it was 16 phone calls early on in the case discussing witnesses and trial strategy in this matter. And then it was noted on the initial argument, prior to even getting to that issue, appellant did not raise this as an issue until after receiving Dr. Robertson's report. And I would note that in his in Dr. Robertson's report, it does not make any reference to appellant acting under duress or any disagreement with the appointment. To the contrary, he's described as friendly, good-natured, cooperative, making eye contact. And granted, that's not determinative, but the record is very clear in this matter that when appellant is in disagreement with something and with a directive, he is very willing to make that disagreement known. And so it is conspicuously absent from that evaluation, which is very thorough, any sort of objection to the selection of Dr. Robertson as the examiner. So at court, At trial, the court heard testimony from the court-appointed examiner and from the and from Dr. Robertson, both of whom concluded that appellant met the criteria for SDP and SPP and should be committed. The examiners were both subjected to extensive cross-examination, and the court ultimately concluded that their testimony and their assessments were reliable and credible.
Can I ask a quick question on this, Mr. Hamilton? Because it seemed like Mr. Kufis was when he's talking about the relaxed, I'll say, application of the rules of evidence in this context, was talking about still there's a need for the court to act as some kind of gatekeeper when it comes to reliability. Do you agree with that? Or do you instead think that these are matters that go to weight, not admissibility?
Your Honor, I agree that there is the case law is clear that the district court does need to diligently vet hearsay statements within these documents. So to answer your question, yes, the district court does need to assess these documents, and the record here is
clear. But is that assessment done to determine admissibility, or is that assessment done as part of weight?
Your Honor, when the exhibits are stipulated to, I would argue that that would go solely to weight. If the appellant could have objected to these exhibits on unreliable hearsay grounds, on admissibility, and he chose
That's a fair point, Mr. Hamilton. But I think let's just assume in this case that there wasn't a stipulation, that there is some, because it sounds to me like Mr. Kufis is now saying there may have been an admission problem, a problem with the admission of the statements because of hearsay. And so I guess my question is, putting aside the inconsistency of that argument with the stipulation here, the case law you're referring to that requires the court to have this diligent, this duty, if you will, to diligently vet reports for hearsay statement, is that a duty that comes in determining admission, or is that a duty that comes in weighing the evidence?
Your Honor, I would argue that that comes from a duty of weighing the evidence. Clearly, if the document is unreliable, then it wouldn't be admissible. But ultimately, vetting these documents, especially when they're documents such as police reports and court records that come in as public records under the hearsay rule, they're admissible under those grounds as well.
Right. I appreciate that. Sorry. And again, I also agree that that's not really the focus here because of the stipulation.
And I would also note just even taking out, I believe there were four exhibits specifically that were contested, and there were two having to do with the 1991 incident with the two underage females who had absconded from treatment, and then the incident and then assorted incidents involving the victims DS and JW. I would just note that the 1991 incident, appellant conceded in his testimony that that incident constituted harmful sexual conduct. His attorney also conceded that in his proposed findings. And then with respect to DS and JW, the court, those were three separate incidents. The court heard firsthand testimony from both of those witnesses and found that testimony credible. So even taking out the admission of those hearsay evidence, there is still reliable, credible testimony of those victims regarding all three of those incidents. And then finally, there is this 2008 incident where an appellant kidnapped an acquaintance and vaginally and anally raped her at his home. There's no argument relating to those exhibits at all. So from the record, those findings regarding the 2008 incident should be deemed as proper findings.
Mr. Hamilton, I want to take your discussion in a little different direction. One of the contentions made by the appellant here is that the district court kind of crossed the line between being the neutral arbiter, fact finder, to being, you know, engaged in the prosecution or showing bias. Where is the line, and why didn't the district court judge, by her questioning of appellant, cross that line impermissibly?
Your Honor, the line clearly it moves And it moves largely depending on whether a trial is a jury trial or a court trial. And the case law is clear that concerns about potentially improper questioning are lessened in a court trial. And the rule is also clear that an objection on improper questioning needs to be made at least contemporaneously or shortly after the fact. And there was no objection to that.
What do we do with the situation we have here where, at least in one circumstance, a district court made a statement or a commentary about the veracity of an answer that the respondent made as opposed to asking a question? I mean, you would agree with me that the district court actually commenting about the veracity of the statement is not proper.
And Your Honor, I don't have that statement in front of me, so I don't, I can't speak to that specific example. I would generally agree that yes, judges should limit their questioning to actual questions and not comments or assertions.
Mr. Hamilton, are you saying, are you arguing that if, let's say, the district court judge in this case, without pointing you to a particular example, that let's just say there's a part of the transcript that I look at and say that is essentially objectionable on because it's argumentative. Are you saying that Mr. Ward has to stand up and say, I object argumentative, or his attorney has to object to an argumentative question from the court?
Your Honor, that is what Rule 614 seems to anticipate. And it doesn't need to be as the questioning is happening, though I think that would probably be appropriate in a court trial. But he at least needs to object after the fact to the line of questioning. And there were a few objections that the counsel did make, but there were no, my recollection is that there were no objections based on.
Do they have to go so far as to say, I believe your question shows you're biased against me?
I believe that would at least need to be alluded to. I believe the objections were mainly on relevance grounds, and they had to do with questions regarding names in the jail calls, and not the damaging testimony that was elicited in that testimony was about the 1991 incident, and there were not there should have been an objection made to that regarding the judge being outside the scope. And I would also note the judge is acting as the fact finder in this case, and they are.
Isn't that the issue? I mean, that's the thing that I'm concerned about. This is the judge as the fact finder, and this is the judge commenting, well, yeah, I would expect you could remember that, or, you know, some of the comments that seem to suggest some, you know, predetermination that this testimony was not credible or whatever, that in and of itself, even in the absence of objection, is concerning as indicative of potential bias. How do you respond to that?
Regarding the question about the jail calls, clearly bias is a concern. I would just note with respect to those answers, it should be looked at in the context of the entire record. And the entire record does indicate that appellant did receive a fair trial. As Your Honor noted, he received, I believe it was 6 trial day continuances. He was allowed to argue his pro se motions. The court encouraged him to bring those motions. It listened to them. It encouraged him to testify. It tried to accommodate his request that his victim or that.
Mr. Hamilton, I'm going to jump in because I know your time's expired, but I want to make sure you're answering this question, which to me is, was it error, not prejudicial and given all the other context of the evidence to be, you know, but was it error for the district court to comment?
Your Honor, is the comment with respect to the jail call saying that
to comment on the truthfulness, if you will, or credibility of the witness as the witness is testifying, is that error?
Your Honor, if the record If the record supports that appellant is not being truthful, I would argue that it was not error. And even if it was error, I would certainly argue that it was not prejudicial error, given that that element of his testimony was not used in any way in this commitment order.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hamilton.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Kufas, we're back to you. You've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. If I could address, and I know Mr. Hamilton and I are at a bit of a disadvantage because neither of us tried the underlying case. So there's probably some nuances that we're not aware of. But what I can tell you is that regarding the stroke and the pre-submission filings, if you look at the court record, it's my recollection and my understanding that the January 28th submission that was made by Mr. Ward. That there was not a final closing argument, findings of fact submitted, that there was a motion that was submitted on January 28th.
Mr. Kufas, can we pick up where we left off with Mr. Sure. Hamilton? So I think that, you know, I'm speaking for myself and not for my colleagues. I have some concerns about the commentary that the district court judge made about the truthfulness of your client's testimony while he was testifying. But taking that isolated commentary in the context of the number of continuances, the district court expressly stating, I want to hear from you. I want to hear what you have to say. Does that, you know, plucking that line out of the transcript, does that taint the entire proceeding? What's the authority for that proposition?
Well, I think it's that taken with the other pieces and the commentary on the truthfulness or non-truthfulness is one thing, but I also, if you look at the admission of whether it was harmful sexual conduct, she was cross-examining him on essentially a legal conclusion for her to be the fact finder of. And so I think it's that entire line of questioning that comes into question.
Mr. Kufas, can I ask you to follow up on a point that Mr. Hamilton raised regarding exhibits? It's one thing not to object. It's another to stipulate to the admissibility of an exhibit and then after the fact on appeal, argue that those were not admissible. Are you arguing that it sounded to me from the brief that there's definitely at least one or two of these exhibits that contained hearsay that you think was inadmissible? And you're challenging the admission of those despite the stipulation that was made. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And in commitment cases, it's a bit different. And just from a practical standpoint, what typically happens in these is that since the rules are lax, everything comes in and then the questioning comes on the specifics of the documents themselves. And that's
right. Well, I don't think that there was any indication that this was a preliminary stipulation or that there was any reservation of admissibility on these or that it was done just to make sure everything was marked in some order that the parties agree on the marking of the exhibits. This was actually an admission or stipulation to the admission of exhibits. And I don't know that just because it was in the context of a commitment proceeding that we can say that wasn't really actually admitting the exhibits.
But Your Honor, I think it has to be looked at in both statements that were made. It's yes, and this is on the first day of the proceedings on page 6 of the transcripts. He agrees to the admissibility, but he specifically states reserving the objection to credibility.
Right, but what does that mean? Is there a rule that says only credible evidence is admitted? To me, reserving an objection to credibility is simply I'm going to argue that the people that are giving statements in these exhibits are not credible, which is something you can always, that's closing argument, right? I don't think there's such a thing as a credibility objection that can be made. Is there a rule you can point me to that would suggest that that's a viable objection that you can reserve?
Yeah, well, under the rules in commitment, Your Honor, again, it's reliable, relevant evidence without laying the basis for a foundation.
Okay, but he didn't say I reserve an objection to reliability. He said credibility, which to me is something that means once it's admitted, there may be a difference of position between the parties on how much weight to give that evidence. That's pretty different than reserving an objection to its admission. And maybe you and I just aren't going to see eye to eye on this today, but it does seem to me that this was a stipulation to admissibility.
Well, and then I guess the question would be then is if that is the case, I mean, by the time that these reports came in, these reports had already gone to the doctors because the doctors received all of the evidence. So this was given in right from the very beginning. So it's part of the record. So really the only opportunity at that point is to object to the specifics. And when I view his wording of credibility, I'm looking at he's looking to object to the reliability, the credibility of what that witness is going to say.
Right. I didn't mean to take up your time. Let me give you a few more seconds to wrap up and let us know the final word here. Go ahead, Mr. Kufis.
Well, and Your Honor, again, I think we addressed, and I think that our brief lays out most of this. I think one of the concerns that we have is from specifically, and it's listed in the footnote in here, but of Dr. Robertson had mentioned that there was some concerns with the reliability of the Hennepin County or the ECRC records that had come in, as well as the Hennepin County records. So I just think in looking at this as an entirety, looking at it as the whole, he didn't get a fair shot. And for that reason, we would ask that the court either reverse it or reverse it to allow him for a new trial.
Well, again, thank you very much for participating this morning. Thank you for your submissions, both written and oral today. It was quite a lengthy addendum and record, so we do appreciate the work that you all put in on behalf of your clients today. The matter is now taken under advisement, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Hope you have a great day. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.